Side 5, Storm of the Century by Stephen King. Continuing on page 207. 156. Interior. The wash basins from Molly and Melinda's point of view. Kneeling in front of one of them is Cora Stanhope. The basin is full of water and Cora's white hair floats on its surface. She has drowned herself in the basin. Written above it in lipstick, on the line of mirrors, is the same old song, "Give me what I want and I'll go away." Flanking it at either end, Cora has drawn bloody lipstick canes. Of the real cane, the one with the wolf's head, there is no sign. Fade to black. This ends Act 4. Act 5. 157. Exterior. The lighthouse. Night. Waves still crash against the headland rocks, hard enough to splatter the lighthouse with foam, but the tide is on the ebb now, and things are better than they were. Temporarily only, however, because... 158. Interior. Lighthouse control room. Night. The lights still blink and flash, but some of them are now beaded with ice from the spray, and little drifts of snow are piling up in the corners of the room. The wind whistles, and the anemometer is still topping 60 miles per hour. Sound. A high-pitched computer beep. The camera moves in on a computer screen that has gone red. White letters appear on the screen. National Weather Service storm surge warning for all outer islands, including Cranberry, Jared Bluff, Kankamongas, Big Tall, and Little Tall. High tide at 7:09 a.m., they produce significant flooding and lowland damage. Outer island residents are strongly advised to move to inland areas of high ground. As if to punctuate this, an especially powerful wave splashes in through the broken windows and splatters this computer screen with foam. 159. Interior. Lower Atlantic Street. Night. Godso Fish and Lobster is totally gone, except for the ragged stump of the building. So is the town dock. The waves slap the rocks where the dock was. Splintered pieces of lobster traps float back and forth, and a single waterlogged bale of pot bobs and surges. 160. Interior. The town office. Night. Ursula's comforting Sandra. Mike is heading for the meeting hall section of the building when Joanna steams past him. He grabs her arm. Mike. Slow down, Mrs. Stanhope. Easy does it. The door between the meeting hall and the office area opens. Molly and Melinda Hatcher come through. Molly's distress turns to gladness when she sees Mike, and she almost hurls herself into his arms. He hugs her hard. Joanna, meanwhile, doesn't give a shit about Easy Does It. She dodges past Melinda and heads down the aisle that leads to the toilets. Ursula and Sandra walk to where Mike and Molly are drawing apart a little. 161. Interior. Town Meeting Hall. Night. Andy and Jill are sitting on a bench about halfway down. Andy has got an arm around his wife, offering what comfort he can when Joanna hurries past toward the ladies' room. Andy.
Joanna, I wouldn't.
She pays no attention, simply hurries on down the aisle. 162. Interior. Ladies' room. Features the door. It opens. Joanna stands there, eyes widening, mouth dropping open. After a moment, Mike joins her. He takes one look and then moves her away. As the bathroom door starts to close on its pneumatic hinge, Mike.
Mal, help me.
163. Interior, the town hall. Mike gently passes the stunned Joanna to his wife, who walks her up the aisle as far as Andy and Jill. There, Joanna stumbles and utters a little cry of bewilderment and grief. Jill.
Let me.
Jill sets her down and puts an arm around her. Joanna begins to weep. Molly starts back toward the ladies' room. Mike comes out, his arms wet almost to the elbows. Molly looks at him questioningly. Mike shakes his head and puts his arm around her shoulders as he leads her past the trio on the bench. Mike.
Andy, can I borrow you a minute?
Andy looks questioningly at Jill, who nods. She's busy comforting Joanna. 164. Interior.
Resume town office area. Mike, Molly, and Andy come in. Ursula and Sandra stand nearby, looking the expected question at Mike. Mike, she's dead, all right. Sandra, can you get me a couple of blankets to wrap her in? Sandra, making a big effort.
Yes, I can do that. Two shakes of the lamb's tail.
Mike is struggling hard to stay calm and do as many of the right things as he can. There is a sense of him making up the procedure as he goes along, but why not? What kind of procedure is there for a situation like this? Sonny Brodigan and Upton Bell come up the stairs, curious about what's going on now. Mike spies them. Mike, Billy Soames, you're sure he's dead? Sonny,
yeah, now what?
Mike, old Mrs. Stanhope is dead too, in the ladies' room. Upton Bell,
holy God, she have a heart attack? Stroke?
Molly,
suicide.
Mike, is Billy still out there in the supply shed? Sonny,
yeah, seemed like the best place. We covered him up.
What the hell? Sandra comes up the stairs with an armload of blankets. Someone else needs covering up now. Mike, Andy, you and Sonny cover Mrs. Stanhope. Take her out and put her with Billy. Use the back door of the meeting hall. I don't want folks to see a corpse going through if I can help it. Sonny,
what about Jonas, her son? I seen him downstairs getting ready to turn in.
Mike, let's hope he does. His wife can tell him in the morning. Upton Bell? Upton.
Yes, sir.
Mike, go downstairs and pick out 5 or 6 men from those that are still up. Guys who can walk through 1/2 mile of deep snow without having a heart attack if it comes to that. Don't tell them anything except that I want to see them, okay? Upton.
Okay.
Hugely excited, Upton heads back downstairs. 165. Interior, the island market, night. Hatch, Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman are sitting at a card table they've set up in the canned goods aisle and are playing gin rummy. Hatch looks up at 166. Interior, the security mirror, from Hatch's point of view. The mirror is now positioned in such a way that Hatch can see into the constable's office. Henry is behind Mike's desk, leaning back in the chair, chin down on his chest, arms crossed, dozing. Robbie sits off to one side watching Manoj, who is back in his same old position, heels up, knees apart, head down. 167. Interior. Resume card players. Satisfied, Hatch draws a card, smiles, and spreads them out face up. Hatch.
Gin.
Kirk.
Ah, booger snot.
168. Interior, the convex anti-theft mirror. Close up. Robbie looks up into the mirror, trying to ascertain if he is being watched. He decides he isn't. Now, he reaches over to the corner of the desk, picks up the pistol that's still lying there, and gets up. 169. Interior, the constable's office. Henry is dozing. The men in the market are playing cards. Robbie approaches the cell with the gun. Manoj sits where he is, watching him come. When Manoj speaks, he does so in the voice of an old woman, Robbie's mother. Manoj.
Where's Robbie? I want to see my Robbie before I go. He said he'd be here. Where are you, Robbie? I don't want to die without someone to hold my hand.
Henry stirs a bit in his doze and sinks deeper. Robbie reacts with surprise, horror, shame, and then his face hardens. Robbie.
I think this town's had enough of you.
He raises the gun and points it through the bars. 170. Exterior, the town hall, night. A side door opens and a number of men come out, ready to augment the crew already at the store. As promised, their wide bodies, Upton, Sonny, Johnny Harriman, Alex Haber, and Stan Hopewell, Davy's father. Stan is a lobsterman we saw briefly in Part 1, battening down for the storm on the now non-existent town dock. They head for the island services vehicle, fighting their way through the snow. Two more figures linger in the doorway, Mike and Molly. Molly's wearing a shawl and hugging it to her against the cold. Molly.
Is it that man? The one who grabbed Ralphie in the market? It is, isn't it?
He doesn't answer. Molly continues.
You'll be all right, won't you?
Mike. Yeah? Molly.
That man, if he is a man, is never going to see the inside of a courtroom, Michael. I know it. You do, too.
Beat.
Maybe you should get rid of him. Make him have an accident.
Mike. Go on inside before you freeze your tail off. She kisses him again, a little more lingeringly. Molly.
Come back to us.
Mike. I will. She closes the door. Mike starts down to the truck, walking in the tracks the others have made and bending forward against the relentless wind. 171. Interior, a sunlit bedroom. Day. This is a beautiful room, full of light. The window is open, and the curtains bell out lazily toward the bed in a summer breeze. Henry Bright comes out of the bathroom wearing only pajama bottoms with a towel slung around his neck. As he crosses to the window, Frank Bright, his son, pokes his head around the side of the door. Frank.
Mom says, come downstairs and get breakfast, Daddy.
Above Frank's head, Carla's now appears. Carla.
No. Mom says, come downstairs and get breakfast, sleepyhead Daddy.
Frank puts his hands over his mouth and giggles. Henry smiles. Henry.
I'll be there in a minute.
He goes to the window. 172. Exterior, little tall island, from Henry's point of view, day. It's beautiful, as only a main island can be at the height of summer. Blue sky over long green meadows that slope down to blue white-capped water. We can see a few fishing boats out there. Gulls cry and swoop overhead. 173. Interior. Resume bedroom with Henry. Day. He takes a deep breath, holds it, then lets it out. Henry.
Thank God for reality. I had a dream that it was winter. There was a storm, and this man came to town.
Linoge. Voice. This scary man. Surprised, Henry turns. 174. Interior. Linoge, from Henry's point of view. Although it's summer in Henry's dream, Linoge is dressed as he was when we first saw him on Atlantic Street in front of Martha Clarendon's house. Peacoat, watch cap, bright yellow gloves. He grimaces into the camera, revealing a mouthful of fangs. His eyes go black. He thrusts the silver head of his cane at Henry, and the head comes alive, snapping and snarling. 175. Interior, the summer bedroom with Henry. He steps backward to avoid the silver wolf. His knees hit the bottom of the window, and he tumbles out, screaming. 176. Exterior, Henry falling. Only it's not his house he's falling out of, and not the ground of little tall island he's falling toward. Hard as that ground might be. He is falling toward a boiling red-black pit of fire. It is a pit of hell. It is also the boiling red and black we've seen in Linoge's eyes from time to time. Henry falls, shrieking, away from the camera. 177. Interior. The constable's office. Features Henry. He twitches in the desk chair, falls out of it, and gives a strangled yell as he hits the floor. He opens his eyes and looks around, dazed. 178. Interior. The market, featuring the card players. They look up at the sound of Henry's yell and see that Robbie is standing by the cell, and... Kirk.
Hatch. Robbie's got a gun. I think he's going to shoot that guy.
Hatch bolts to his feet, knocking over the card table.
Hatch. Robbie, get away from him. Put that down.
179. Interior, the constable's office with Henry. Henry.
Robbie, what?
Henry gets to his feet. He's soupy, still half lost in his dream. 180. Interior, the cell with Robbie and Robbie's false mother.
She is sitting on the bunk where Linoge sat.
Naturally, she is Linoge. She is very old,
About 80 and very thin. She is dressed in a white hospital johnny. Her hair is wild. Her face is reproachful. Robbie looks at her, hypnotized. False mother.
Robbie, why didn't you come? After all I did for you, all I gave up for you.
Hatch, voice. Robbie, don't. False mother.
Why did you leave me to die with strangers? Why did you leave me to die alone?
She holds out her thin, trembling hands to him. 181. Interior, the market. Hatch, Jack, and Kirk dash for the open door of the constable's office. 182. Interior, the constable's office. Henry, still hardly aware of what's happening, walks toward the cell. Manoj is sitting on the bunk, holding out his hands to Robbie, and here, from Henry's perspective, it really is Manoj. Manoj looks at the door leading into the market. It slams shut in Hatch's face.
183. Interior, the market side of the door, with Hatch, Jack, Kirk.
Hatch actually strikes the door and bounces off. He tries the handle, but it won't turn. He slams his shoulder against the door, then turns to the other two. Hatch.
Don't just stand there. Help me.
184. Interior. Resume constable's office. We hear thuds as the men outside try to break down the door. The false mother sits on the cot in her johnny, looking at her wayward son. False mother.
I waited for you, Robbie, and I'm still waiting for you. Down in hell, I'm waiting for you.
Robbie.
You stop, or I'll shoot you.
False mother.
With that?
She looks at the gun contemptuously. Robbie follows her gaze. 185. Interior. Robbie's hand, from Robbie's point of view, close up. The gun is gone. He's holding a writhing snake. Robbie screams and opens his hand. 186. Interior. The constable's office. We see the rest of this from Henry Bright's point of view, which means we see things pretty much as they are. It's the gun Robbie drops, not a snake, and it's Manoj in the cell, now off the bunk and walking toward the bars. Manoj.
I'll be waiting for you in hell, Robbie, and when you get there, I'll have a spoon. I'm going to use it on your eyes. I'm going to eat your eyes, Robbie, over and over again, because hell is repetition. Born in sin. Come on in.
Henry bends for the gun. Manoj looks at it, and it slides all the way across the floor. Manoj looks back at Robbie, looks hard, and Robbie suddenly goes flying backward. He strikes the wall, rebounds, and goes to his knees. Henry, horrified whisper.
What are you?
Manoj,
your destiny.
He turns and lifts the mattress of the cot. Beneath it is the cane. He takes it and raises it. As he does, a brilliant blue light begins to shine from it. Henry backs away, raising an arm to shield his eyes. Robbie, who has managed to get up, also shields his eyes. That glow becomes bright, brighter, brightest. The constable's office now screams with light. 187. Interior, the market side of the door. Light streams through the keyhole, around the hinges, and through the gap at the foot of the door. The three men step back, afraid. Jack.
What is it? What's happening?
Hatch.
I don't know.
188. Interior. The constable's office.
Henry and Robbie stand on one side of the room, cringing against that brilliant flood of light. In it, we see for the first time Linoge for what he is.
An ancient wizard whose upraised cane is his chief instrument of magic, an evil version of Aaron's staff. It is shedding that brilliant light in waves. On the bulletin board, papers come loose and float in the air. Mike's blotter rises from his desk and also floats. The desk drawers open, slowly, one after the other, and the objects inside rise up and begin to circle the desk. Pens and paperclips, handcuffs, and a forgotten half of ham sandwich. The in-out basket waltzes with Hatch's power book in midair.
On the far side of the room, the pistol Robbie meant to use on Linoge, what a foolish idea that seems now, rises,
turns its muzzle to the wall and discharges 6 times.
189. Interior. The market side of the door. Hatch, Kirk, and Jack react to the shots. Hatch looks around, sees a display of hardware, and grabs a hatchet from it. He turns and begins hacking away at the area around the doorknob. Jack grabs at him. Jack.
Hatch, maybe you shouldn't.
Hatch shoves him backward and goes on hacking. Maybe he shouldn't, but he's going to do his duty if he can. 190. Interior. The constable's office. The home-welded bars start falling away from the cell door one by one, almost like falling leaves. Robbie and Henry watch, numb with terror. The bars fall faster and faster, creating a man-shaped hole. When it's complete, Linoge steps easily through. He looks at the two cowering men, then turns and raises his cane toward the door leading to the market. 191. Interior. The market side of the door. Hatch is raising the hatchet for another blow when the door suddenly opens on its own. Bright bluish silver light streams out. Linoge. Voice.
Hatch.
Hatch steps into that flood of light. Jack grabs at him. Jack.
Hatch! No!
Hatch ignores him. He goes into the light, the hatchet slipping from his fingers as he does. 192. Exterior. The market. Night. The Island Service's four-wheel drive turns into the front parking area. The storm shutters are down over the market's display windows, but we can see the brilliant blue light shining through the door. 193. Interior. The Island Service's vehicle. It's crammed with beefy guys. Mike is at the wheel. Johnny, awed.
What in the hell is that?
Mike doesn't bother answering, but he's out of the truck almost before it has stopped moving. The others follow, but Mike is first up the steps. 194. Interior. The constable's office. Hatch sleepwalks into that brilliant light, heedless of the objects floating and swirling in the air. The power book bumps his head. Hatch bats it aside, and it floats away like something underwater. He reaches Linoge, who is almost blindingly bright. Linoge is in reality an old man, we see, with ragged white hair falling almost to his shoulders. His cheeks and brow are carved with lines, and his lips are sunken, but it's a strong face all the same, and dominated by the eyes, which swirl with black and red. His ordinary clothes are gone. He is wearing a dark robe that gleams with shifting silver patterns. He continues to hold his staff up with one hand. There is still a silver wolf's head at one end, but now we see the shaft is carved with magical runes and symbols, and grips Hatch's shoulder with the other. Only it's not really a hand at all, but a talon full of claws. Linoge brings his face down until his brow is almost touching Hatch's, his lips part, revealing his pointed teeth. During all of this, Hatch stares at him with wide, blank eyes. Linoge,
give me what I want, and I'll go away. Tell them, give me what I want, and I'll go away.
He turns, the hem of his robe flaring, and strides toward the door that leads to the loading dock. 195. Interior. The market looking toward the main doors. Night. They burst open, and Mike runs in, followed by his posse. He moves up the center aisle, jumping the overturned card table, and grabs Kirk Freeman. Mike.
What happened? Where's Hatch?
Kirk points numbly into the constable's office. He is beyond words. Mike plunges through the doorway, then stops. 196. Interior, the constable's office, from Mike's point of view. Looks like a cyclone struck it. Papers and office supplies are strewn everywhere, fluttering in the draft from the open loading dock door. Hatch's power book lies shattered on the floor. The jail cell is empty. A litter of bars lies in front of the door, which is still locked, but gaping wide all the same. The hole is vaguely man-shaped. Robbie and Henry stand against the wall, their arms around each other, like small children who are lost in the dark. Hatch stands in the center of the floor with his back to Mike and his head lowered. Mike approaches cautiously. The other men clog the door to the market,
watching with big eyes and solemn faces. Mike. Hatch. What happened? Hatch doesn't respond until Mike actually touches his shoulder. Mike. What happened? Hatch turns. His face has been changed in some fundamental way by his close encounter with Lenoge, stamped by a terror that may never leave him, even if he survives the storm of the century. Mike reacts.
Hatch!
My God! What? Hatch. We have to give him what he wants. If we do that, he'll go away. He'll leave us alone. If we don't. Hatch looks toward the open loading dock door where snow is swirling in. Robbie joins them, walking slowly like an old man. Robbie.
Where did he go?
Hatch. Out there. Into the storm. Now they all look toward the door. 197. Exterior. Downtown, looking toward the ocean. Night. The snow is pelting. The drifts are still building, and the sea is still pounding the shore and sending up airbursts of foam. Lenoge is out there someplace, just another part of the storm. Fade to black. This ends Act 5. Act 6. 198. Exterior. Intersection of Maine and Atlantic. Night. The drifts are deeper than ever, and several show windows have been broken inward. The streets are impassable to even four-wheel drives now. The lampposts are buried halfway to their light globes. The camera moves back to the drugstore, and we see the aisles have become frozen tundra. Frost twinkles on the letters spelling prescriptions at the back of the store. Nearer the front, there's a sign that reads, "Beat Old Man Winter with a Genie Heater." But Old Man Winter's got the last laugh this time. The heaters are almost buried in snow. The pendulum clock is too covered with snow to read, but still working. It begins to strike the hour. 1, 2, 3, 4. 199. Interior. Martha Clarendon's front hall. Night. We see her body covered with the tablecloth. And hear another striking clock. 5, 6, 7, 8. 200. Interior, the Wee Folks Daycare Center. Night. A cuckoo bird Molly's kids must love is running in and out of the clock on the wall, impudent as a tongue. 9, 10, 11, 12. With that last comment, the bird goes back into hiding. The daycare itself is spotless but spooky, with its little tables and chairs, its pictures on the walls, the blackboard with "We say please" and "We say thank you" written on it. There are too many shadows, too much silence. 201. Exterior. The loading dock behind the store. Night. We see Peter Godso's wrapped body, now just a frozen lump under the tarp, but those boots are still sticking out. 202. Interior. The constable's office. It's still littered with paper and office supplies from hell to breakfast, and the fallen bars still lie where they fell, but the place is empty. The camera moves through the door to the market. It is also empty. The overturned table and litter of cards in the canned goods aisle testifies that there was sudden trouble here, but trouble has departed now. The big clock over the checkout counters, a battery job, reads 1:01. 203. Interior. The supply shed behind the town hall. Night. There are two wrapped bodies here, those of Billy Soames and Cora Stanhope. 204. Interior. The town hall kitchen. Night. Neat as a pin. Clean counters, swept floor, washed pots heaped high in the drainers. A small army of town ladies with too much time on their hands, no doubt generaled by Mrs. Kingsbury, has put things to rights, and the place is all ready for breakfast. Pancakes for 200 or so. On the wall, the clock reads 2:02. Like We Folks Daycare, this place feels spooky, with the minimal lighting supplied by the Jenny and the wind screaming outside. Sitting on stools by the door are Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman. They have hunting rifles across their laps. Both are close to dozing.
Kirk, how are we supposed to see anything in this?
Jack shakes his head. He doesn't know. 205. Interior. The town office. Night. The CB radio crackles softly and meaninglessly. There's nothing on it but static. At the door, Hatch and Alex Haber are watching, also armed with hunting rifles. Well, Hatch is watching. Alex is dozing. Hatch looks at him, and we see him debating whether or not to elbow Alex awake. He decides to have pity.
The camera slips to Ursula's desk, where Tess Marchant sleeps with her head pillowed on her arms.
The camera studies her for a moment, then turns and floats down the stairs. As it does, we hear a faint voice through static. Preacher. Voice.
You know, friends, it's hard to be righteous, but it's easy to go along with so-called friends who tell you that sin is all right, that neglect is fine, that no God is watching, and you can go ahead and do whatever you think you can get away with. Can you say hallelujah?
Muttered response. Hallelujah. There are about 10 people left in the TV area. They have gravitated to the few comfortable chairs and a couple of old rummage sale quality sofas. All but Mike are asleep. On the TV, barely visible through the interference, is the slicky-haired preacher, looking every bit as trustworthy as Jimmy Swaggart in the courtyard of a XXX motel. Mike speaks to the TV. Hallelujah, brother. Tell it. He's in an overstuffed chair, a little apart from the rest. He looks very tired and probably won't be awake for much longer. He's already started to nod out. On his hip, he's wearing his revolver in a holster. Preacher continues.
Brethren, tonight I'd like to speak to you especially of the secret sin. And tonight I'd like to remind you, say hallelujah, that sin tastes sweet on the lips but sour on the tongue, and it poisons the belly of the righteous. God bless you, but can you say amen?
Mike cannot, as it happens. His chin has drifted down to his chest and his eyes have closed. Preacher continues.
But the secret sin, the selfish heart that says, I need not share, I can keep it all for myself, and no one will ever know. Think of that, brethren. It's easy to say, oh, I can keep that dirty little secret. It's nobody else's business, and it won't hurt me. And then try to ignore the canker of corruption that begins growing around it. That soul sickness that begins to grow around it.
During this, the camera pans some of the sleeping faces. Among them we see Sonny Brodigan and Upton Bell, snoring on one sofa with their heads together, and on the other, Jonas and Joanna Stanhope with their arms around each other. Then we float away again toward those makeshift draw curtains. Behind us, the preacher's voice fades. He continues to talk about secrets and sin and selfishness. We drift through the draw curtains. Here in the sleeping area, we hear dormitory sounds of repose. Coughs, wheezes, soft snores. We pass Davy Hopewell, sleeping on his back with a frown on his face. Robbie Beals on his side, reaching across to Sandra. They are holding hands in their sleep. Ursula Godso sleeping with her daughter Sally and her sister-in-law Tavia close by, the three of them drawn as tightly together as they can in the wake of Peter's death. Melinda Hatcher and Pippa are sleeping with their cots pushed together, forehead to forehead, and Ralphie is cradled in his sleeping mother's arms. We drift to the area where the kids were initially put to bed, and quite a few of them are still there. Buster Carver, Harry Robichaud, Heidi St. Pierre, and Don Beals. The residents of Little Tall are sleeping. Their rest is uneasy, but they are sleeping. 206. Interior. Robbie Beals, close up. He mutters something incoherent. His eyeballs move rapidly behind his closed lids. He's dreaming. 207. Exterior, Main Street, Little Tall Island, day. Standing in the street, actually above it, as Main Street is buried under at least 4 feet of snow, is a TV reporter. He is young and conventionally handsome, dressed in a bright purple thermo-pack ski suit, matching purple gloves and wearing skis. The only way he could get to his stand-up position, one assumes. There's 4 feet of snow in the streets, But that's only the beginning. The stores have been all but buried under monster drifts. Downed power lines disappear into the snow like torn strands of cobweb. TV reporter. The so-called storm of the century is history in New England now. Folks from New Bedford to New Hope are digging out from beneath snowfall amounts that have added not just new entries, but new pages to the record book. The reporter begins to ski slowly down Main Street, past the drugstore, the hardware store, the Handy Bob restaurant, the tie-up lounge, the beauty parlor. TV reporter. They're digging out everywhere, that is, except here on Little Tall Island, a little scrap of land off the coast of Maine and home to almost 400 souls, according to the last census. About half the population sought shelter on the mainland when it became clear that this storm was really going to hit, and hit hard. That number includes most of the island's school children in grades K through high school. But nearly all the rest, 200 men and women and young children, are gone. The exceptions are even more ominous and distressing. 208. Exterior. The remains of the town dock. Day. Teams of grim-faced emergency medical technicians are carrying four stretchers down to the police boat that is tied up to the stump of the dock. Each stretcher bears a zipped body bag. TV reporter. Voiceover. Four corpses have been found so far on Little Tall Island. Two of them may have been suicides, police sources say, but the other two are almost certainly murder victims, bludgeoned to death by what was probably the same blunt object. 209. Exterior. Resume Main Street with reporter. Uh-oh. He's still wearing the purple ski suit. Still clean cut and as chipper as a chickadee, but the purple gloves have been replaced by bright yellow ones. If we didn't recognize Linoge before, and hopefully we didn't, we do now. TV reporter. Linoge.
Identities of the dead have been withheld pending notification of next of kin, but all are said to be longtime island residents, and baffled police are asking themselves one question over and over. Where are the other residents of Little Tall Island? Where is Robert Beals, the town manager? Where is Michael Anderson, who owns the island market and served as Little Tall's constable? Where is 14-year-old Davy Hopewell, who was at home, recovering from a bout of mononucleosis when the big one hit? Where are the shopkeepers, the fishermen, the town selectmen? No one knows. There has only been one case like this before in all of American history.
210. Interior, Molly Anderson sleeping, close up, night. Her eyes move rapidly back and forth beneath her closed lids. 211. Insert, a drawing of an 18th century village. Woman TV reporter, voiceover.
This is how the village of Roanoke, Virginia looked in 1587, before everyone disappeared. Every man, woman, and child. Their fate has never been discovered. A single possible clue was discovered, a word found carved on a tree.
212. Insert, a woodcut of an elm tree. Carved into the bark is the word Croatan. Woman, TV reporter. Voiceover.
This word, Croatan. The name of a place? A misspelling? A word written in a language lost over the centuries? No one knows that either.
213. Exterior. Resume Main Street with woman TV reporter. She is very pretty in her purple Thermapak ski suit. It goes well with her long blonde hair, flushed cheeks, and her bright yellow gloves. Yes, it's Linoge again, now speaking in a woman's voice and looking very pretty. This isn't transvestism played for laughs, but a guy who really looks like a young woman and speaks with a woman's voice. This is deadly serious. This reporter has picked up exactly where Robbie's version left off, now doing a walk and talk, a walk and ski in this case, up Main Street toward the town hall. Woman TV reporter, Linoge.
Police continue to assure reporters that a solution will be found, but even they are not able to deny one essential fact. Hope is dimming for the missing residents of Little Tall Island.
She skis on toward the town hall, which is also buried in drift. Woman TV reporter, Linoge.
Evidence suggests that most or all of the islanders spent the first and worst night of the storm here, in the basement of the Little Tall Island town hall. After that, no one knows. One wonders if there was anything they could have done to change their strange fate.
She skis onto what would be the town hall lawn in summer, toward the little cupola with the bell inside. The camera remains stationary now, watching her go. 214. Interior. Davy Hopewell. Close-up. Sleeping uneasily. Eyeballs moving. Dreaming while the wind shrieks outside. 215. Exterior. In front of the town hall. Day. The reporter in the purple ski suit reaches the cupola, and even with his back to us, we can tell that Davy's version of the reporter is a man. He turns. He is balding, bespectacled, wearing a mustache, but it's Linoge again. TV reporter, Linoge.
One wonders if, in their insular selfishness and Yankee pride, they refused to give something, some simple thing, that would have changed matters for them. To this reporter, that seems more than possible. It seems plausible. Do they regret it now? Pause. Are any of them alive to regret it? What really happened in Roanoke in 1587? And what happened here, on Little Tall Island, in 1989? We may never know. But I know one thing, Davy. You're too damn short to play basketball. And besides, you couldn't throw it in the ocean.
Davy's version of the reporter makes a half turn and reaches into the shadowy cupola. Here is the memorial bell, only in Davy's dream, it's not a bell. What the reporter brings out is a blood-stained basketball, and he heaves it directly into the camera. As he does this, his lips part in a grin, revealing teeth that are really fangs. TV reporter,
catch.
216. Interior. Resume. Davy in the town hall basement. Night. Moaning, he turns back the other way. His hands come up briefly, as if to ward off the basketball. Davy.
No. No.
217. Interior, the TV area of the basement, featuring Mike. Night. His head is dropped and limp, but his eyeballs are moving behind his closed lids, and, like the others, he is dreaming. Preacher. Voice.
Be sure that your sin will find you out, and that your secrets will be known. All secrets will be known.
218. Interior. Preacher on snowy TV. Close-up. Yes, now we see it. The TV preacher is Linoge, too. Preacher. Continues.
Can you say hallelujah? Oh, brethren, can you say amen? For I ask you to behold the sting of sin and the price of vice. I ask you to behold the just end of those who bar the door to the wandering stranger who comes asking so little.
The camera moves in on the snowy TV. The preacher melts into darkness, but a snowy darkness, because the wind has blown down the town hall antenna, and there's no good reception. Only now a picture starts to appear anyway. The snow is real snow now, snow that's a part of the storm of the century, and people are moving in it, a dark snake dance of people floundering their slow way down Atlantic Street Hill. 219. Interior. Atlantic Street. Closer. Night. Preacher. Voice over.
For the wages of lust are dust, and the wages of sin are death.
Passing us is a nightmare procession of dazed, hypnotized islanders in their nightclothes, oblivious of the howling wind and sheeting snow. We see Angela with little Buster in her arms, followed by Molly in her nightgown and carrying Ralphie, followed by George Kirby, Ferd Andrews, Roberta Coyne. Well, you get it. They're all here. And tattooed on each forehead is that strange and ominous word, Croatan. Preacher. Voiceover.
For if the supplicant is turned away and the seeker given no respite, shall not the hard-hearted be sent hence.
220. Interior. Mike. Close-up. Mike. Sleeping. Hallelujah. Amen. 221. Interior, the stump of the town dock. They march toward the camera and their death in the frigid ocean, like lemmings. We don't believe it. And yet we do, don't we? After Jonestown and Heaven's Gate, we do. Robbie, first in line.
I'm sorry we didn't give you what you wanted.
He topples off the jagged end of the dock and into the ocean. Or Busher, second in line.
Sorry we didn't give it to you, Mr. Lenoge.
He follows Robbie into the ocean. Next is Angie and Buster. Angie Carver.
I'm sorry. We both are, aren't we, Buster?
With the child in her arms, Angela steps from the pier. Next is Molly with Ralphie. 222. Interior. Resume Mike in the TV area. He is growing steadily more restive, as who would not, if subjected to such an awful dream as this. Mike. No.
No, Molly.
Preacher. Voiceover.
For so little is asked of you, can you say hallelujah? And yet, if you harden your hearts and stop up the porches of your ears, you must pay. You must be branded as one of the ungrateful and sent hence.
223. Exterior. Molly. On the pier. Night. She is as hypnotized as the rest, but Ralphie is awake and afraid. Molly.
We hardened our hearts. We closed our ears. And now we pay. I'm sorry, Mr. Lenoge.
Ralphie.
Daddy! Daddy, help!
Molly.
We should have given you what you wanted.
She goes over the edge and into the black water with Ralphie screaming in her arms. 224. Interior, the TV area with Mike. Night. He snaps awake, gasping, looks at the TV. 225. Interior, TV from Mike's point of view. Nothing but snow. The station has either lost its tower to the storm or ceased broadcasting for the night. 226. Interior, resume Mike. He sits upright, trying to get his breath back. Sonny Brodigan.
Mike.
Sonny lumbers over, looking disheveled and puffy with sleep, his hair sticking up in the back. Sonny.
Man, I just had the most awful dream. This reporter.
Now, Upton Bell joins them. Upton.
On Main Street, talking about how everybody was gone.
He stops. He and Sonny look at each other in mutual amazement. Sonny.
Like in this little town in Virginia a long time ago.
Melinda. Voice.
No one knew where they went, and in the dream, no one knew where we went.
They look toward the draw curtains. Melinda is standing there in her nightgown. Melinda.
They're all dreaming it. Do you understand? They are all dreaming what we dreamed.
She looks back toward 227. Interior. The sleeping area. Night. The sleepers are in slow, twisty motion on their cots. They moan and protest without waking. 228. Interior. Resume TV area. Melinda.
But where could 200 people disappear to?
Sonny and Upton shake their heads. Tess comes halfway down the stairs. Her hair is mussed. She still looks half asleep.
Tess Marchant. Especially on a little island, cut off by a big storm.
Mike gets up and snaps off the TV. Mike. Into the ocean. Melinda, shocked.
What?
Mike. Into the ocean. Mass suicide, if we don't give him what he wants. Sonny.
How could he?
Mike.
I don't know, but I think he can.
Molly comes through the draw curtains, holding Ralphie in her arms. Ralphie is fast asleep, but she can't bear to let him go. Molly.
What does he want, though? Mike, what does he want?
Mike. I'm sure we'll find out when he's ready. 229. Exterior. The lighthouse. Night. The light swings around and around, briefly cutting through the driving snow on each swing. In one of the shattered windows at the top, a shape stands. The camera moves in on Lenoge, who stands looking out at the town with his hands behind his back. He has the air of a ruler surveying his kingdom. At last, he turns away. 230. Interior. Lighthouse control room. Night. Manoj, little more than a shadow in the red lights of the control panel, crosses the circular room and opens the door to the stairs. The camera moves in on the computer screen we saw before, marching down from the top, replacing the storm surge warning for the morning's high tide is this message, repeated over and over. Give me what I want. 231. Interior. The lighthouse staircase. Night. We're looking down this dizzying spiral at Manoj, who is descending rapidly. 232. Exterior. The lighthouse. Night. Manoj comes out, wolf's head cane in hand, and moves off into the snow, headed God knows where to do God knows what mischief. We hold on the lighthouse, then fade to black. This ends Act 6. Act 7. 233. Exterior, the downtown area. Morning. The snow is falling as fast and hard as ever. Buildings are half buried. Power lines disappear into the snow. It looks like the newscast walk and ski we saw in the dream, only with the storm still going on. 234. Exterior, the town hall. Morning. The cupola with the memorial bell in it is almost buried, and the brick town hall building itself looks ghostly. The wind howls unabated. 235. Interior, the town meeting hall. Morning. About half of the folks who took shelter in the town hall are here, sitting on the hard wooden benches with plates on their laps, eating pancakes and drinking juice. A kind of buffet has been set up at the back of the hall, with Mrs. Kingsbury, wearing a brilliant red hunter's cap with the bill turned around backward, gangster style, and Tess Marchant officiating. There's juice, coffee, and cold cereal in addition to the pancakes. The folks eating breakfast are very quiet, not sullen, but introspective and a little afraid. All the families with small children are up. Of course they are. We folks rise and shine early. And among them, we see the Hatchers and the Andersons in a sleepy morning party of six. Mike is feeding Ralphie bites of pancake, and Hatch is doing about the same with Pippa. The wives drink coffee and talk quietly. The side door opens, letting in a howl of wind, a swirl of snow, and an excited Johnny Harriman. Johnny.
Mike. Hey, Mikey. I never seen such a storm surge in my life. I think the lighthouse is going to go. I really do.
The islanders stir and murmur. Mike puts Ralphie on Molly's lap and gets up. Hatch gets up, too, and so do most of the others. Mike. Folks, if you go out, stay close to the building. We've got whiteout conditions, remember. 236. Exterior. Angle on the headland and the lighthouse. Morning. The tide is coming high, and huge waves pound the rocks. The headland is almost inundated with each one. The base of the lighthouse is drowned with each incoming surge of water. The lighthouse survived last night's high tide. It probably won't survive this one. 237. Exterior. The side of the town hall. Morning. Islanders spill out, chattering, some buttoning their coats, some knotting scarves under their chins, some pulling up hoods and yanking down ski masks. 238. Interior, the town meeting room. Morning. The last of the people going out are just slipping through the easing clog at the side door. What's left in here are a few people who don't want to quit eating, plus seven mommies and one daddy, Jack Carver, coping with little kids who are exceedingly reluctant to be left out of the excitement. Ralphie.
Mommy, please can't I go see?
Molly exchanges a look with Melinda. It's exasperated and amused at the same time, a look that only the parents of preschool children know. Pippa, picking up on it.
Please, Mommy, please can't I?
Don Beals, meanwhile, is employing a more masterful approach with Sandra. Don.
Put my coat on. I want to go out. Hurry up, you slowpoke.
Molly, to Ralphie.
Oh, all right.
To Melinda.
Hey. I want to see, too.
To Ralphie.
Come on, Ralphie. Let's find your coat.
Most of the other parents, Linda St. Pierre, Carla Bright, Jack Carver, Jill Robichaud, are doing the same.
Ursula Godso, however, is resisting Sally's imploring. Ursula.
Mommy can't, honey. She's too tired. I'm sorry.
Sally.
Daddy will take me. Where's Daddy?
Ursula can't think of an answer and is on the verge of tears. The other ladies who overhear are melting with sympathy. Sally doesn't know yet that her father is dead. Jenna Freeman.
I'll take you out, hon, if it's okay with your mom.
Ursula nods, gratefully. 239. Exterior, the side lawn of the town hall, morning. About 70 island residents are clustered in a loose line, all standing with their backs to us, all looking toward the ocean. The parents come from the side door, either carrying young, bundled-up children or leading them by the hand. They occasionally sink hip-deep in the new snow and have to help each other out of the drifts. There is some laughter. The excitement has helped to stir them out of their post-dream introspection. In the foreground, the black barrel of a cane comes down, burying itself in the snow. 240. Exterior, the rear of the town hall, morning. Linoge is standing here, watching the townsfolk through the heavy snow. They don't see him because their backs are turned. 241. Exterior, headland and lighthouse, from the town hall's point of view, morning. From here, the lighthouse is almost obscured by the snow. From time to time, it will be obscured. But right now, we can see both it and the giant waves surging around it. 242. Exterior, Mike and Hatch, morning. Hatch.
Is it gonna go, Mike?
Molly and Melinda, accompanied by Ralph and Pippa, join their husbands. Mike bends to pick up Ralphie without taking his eyes off the lighthouse. Mike.
I think it is.
243. Exterior, headland and lighthouse, from the town hall's point of view. A huge wave smacks the headland and surges around the lighthouse. Then the wind howls, the snow thickens, and the lighthouse is hardly there, only a dim white ghost in the swirling snow. 244. Interior, the lighthouse control room. Water pours in through the shattered windows and inundates the electronic gear. Sparks fly. The computers short out. 245. Exterior, headland and lighthouse, from the town hall's point of view. Except we really can't see much at all now, except for a couple of houses and some ghostly trees down the hill from where the people stand. The snow has thickened, and the wind is swirling it up, creating whiteout conditions. 246. Exterior. The townsfolk. A panning shot. Morning. We see the little family groups and clusters of friends. Sonny and Upton Bell are together. Kirk and his younger sister, Jenna, accompanied by little Sally Godso, are standing near the Beals'. But some folks stand a bit apart from the others. Behind them all, the snow provides a shifting white backdrop. The town hall itself is only a pink shadow. As we pan. Kirk.
I can't see a thing.
Ferd Andrews.
It's a damn whiteout.
Don Beals.
Daddy, where's the lighthouse?
Robbie, to Don.
Wait for the wind to drop, honey.
Don.
Make it drop now.
Davy Hopewell, to Mrs. Kingsbury.
Look, there's the light just coming around. It's still there.
247. Interior, looking into the whiteout from the islander's point of view. Morning. In all that swirling snow, the searchlight gleams fitfully, brightens, then revolves out of sight again. As it does, we begin to see the headland once more. 248. Exterior, resume panning townspeople. Morning. Hatch. It's lifting. Mrs. Kingsbury is standing to the left of the Hopewells, her red hunting cap, now turned around so the bill faces front. Bright yellow gloves. Linoge must have had another pair of them stashed somewhere, come out of the snow. One clamps over Mrs. Kingsbury's mouth, the other grabs her by the neck. She is jerked backward into the whiteout. The Hopewells are quite close by, but none of them see. They are peering into the snow as hard as they can. 249. Exterior. Headland and lighthouse from the town hall's point of view. A gigantic wave smashes into the headland, humps up, and crashes into the lighthouse. And now we can see it beginning to tilt. 250. Exterior. Sonny Brodigan and Upton Bell. Sonny.
She going. Holy God, she's surely going.
Near them is a male resident bundled up in a grease-stained parka with Island Easy Pump written on the left breast. A shape, Winoge, looms behind him. It pauses for a second or two, and then the cane comes down across Mr. Easy Pump's throat, gripped at either end by bright yellow gloves. Mr. Easy Pump is yanked backward into the whiteout. Neither Sonny nor Upton notice. They are thrilled by the destruction taking place below. 251. Exterior. The whiteout, looking back toward the town hall. We see two black shapes, the soles of Mr. Easy Pump's boots. They float briefly in all that white, then disappear. 252. Exterior. The lighthouse. Morning. Another of those huge waves buries the lower half. We hear the rumble of water and the groan of crumbling bricks. The lighthouse's tilt becomes more pronounced. 253. Interior. The lighthouse control room. Morning. It's tilting. Tilting. Water pouring in. The tilt becoming more pronounced as equipment comes unanchored and begins to slide down the steepening slope of the floor. 254. Exterior. The islanders outside the town hall. Morning. The camera is behind them, panning from left to right. From between them or over their shoulders, we can see the tottering lighthouse. 255. Exterior. Jack, Angie, and Buster Carver. Morning. Jack is highly excited. He sweeps Buster into his arms and lunges forward a little through the snow. Jack.
Look, Buster. The lighthouse is falling down.
Buster.
Falling down. Lighthouse falling down.
Angela is about four steps behind them. Neither Jack nor Buster see the yellow gloves as they float out of the snow, grab her, and yank her backward into the white curtain. 256. Exterior. Resume lighthouse. Morning. The inundating wave retreats. For a moment, it seems, the lighthouse might endure yet a little longer, and then it goes crashing down, the light above the shattered control room still revolving valiantly. As it falls, another wave strikes, drowning the ruins. 257. Exterior. The islanders. Panic. They are silent, their brief excitement gone. Now that it's actually happened, they wish it had not. We end up on Jack and Buster. Buster.
Where's the lighthouse, Daddy? Did it go bye-bye?
Jack, sadly.
Yeah, honey. I guess so. Lighthouse went bye-bye.
Turning.
Angie, did you see it? Did you...
But there's no one where she was standing. Jack.
Angie! Angela!
He looks up and down the line of islanders, puzzled but not yet worried or afraid. He doesn't see her. Jack.
Hey, Ange!
Buster.
Hey, Mommy!
Jack looks at Orv Boucher, who is standing nearby. Jack.
Did you see my wife?
Orv.
Gee, Jack, I didn't notice. Maybe she got cold and went back inside.
258. Exterior. The Hopewell family. Stan, Mary, and Davy. Morning. Davy's parents are still looking down at the place where the lighthouse stood, as if expecting an instant replay. But Davy is looking around, frowning. Davy.
Mrs. Kingsbury.
Mary Hopewell. Hears him.
Davy?
Davy.
She was just here.
Jack comes slogging along, now holding Buster by the hand. Jack.
Angie!
To Buster.
I guess Orv's right. She must have gotten cold and gone back inside.
Nearby are Alex Haber and Cal Freeze. Cal, looking around.
Hey, where's old George Kirby?
259. Exterior. The Andersons and the Hatchers. Morning. Along the ragged line of islanders who have come out to watch the lighthouse go down, Cal and Alex are calling for George Kirby. Jack and Buster are calling for Angela. Davy Hopewell is calling for Mrs. Kingsbury, and a couple of other folks are calling for Bill, the real name of Mr. Easy Pump, one assumes. A kind of sick realization is dawning on Mike's face. He looks at Hatch and sees much the same look there. Mike sets Ralphie down and turns to the ragged line of islanders. Mike, back inside. Everyone back inside. Molly.
Mike, what's wrong?
Mike ignores her. He begins running down the line of islanders, looking frantic. Mike. Inside. Everybody. Now. And stay together. His fear communicates itself to the islanders, who begin to turn and go inside. Robbie comes over to Mike. Robbie.
What the hell's this?
Mike. Maybe nothing. For now, just go inside. Take your wife and your boy and go inside. As he gets Robbie turned around and begins shepherding him back to Sandra and Don, Jack Carver comes floundering up through the snow, holding Buster. Jack, now beginning to be afraid.
Michael, have you seen Angela? She was right here.
Robbie begins to understand. He goes to Sandra and Buster, suddenly not wanting them out of his sight. Mike, take your boy on inside, Jack. Jack,
but...
Mike, go on now. Do it. 260. Exterior. Hatch on the snowfield beside the town hall. Around him, people are hurrying back to the side door. Most look fearful. Hatch ignores them, trying to look everywhere at once, an impossible trick given the thick snow. Hatch.
Mrs. Kingsbury.
George.
George Kirby.
Bill Timmons, where are you at? He sees a bright splash of red and goes to it. He picks up Mrs. Kingsbury's hat, dusts the snow from it with his gloved hand, and looks at it gravely as Mike comes up to him, herding people along. Mike's eyes also move everywhere. They are shepherds, trying to guard a diminishing flock. Mike takes the hat from Hatch and looks at it for a moment. Mike. Inside. Inside now. Stick together. 261. Interior, the town meeting hall, features Jack and Buster. Buster.
Where's Mommy? We left Mommy outside. Daddy, we left Mommy outside.
Jack, beginning to cry.
Come on, big boy. Mommy's fine.
He almost drags Buster up the aisle and toward the door leading to the town office and the stairs. 262. Interior, montage of islanders, meeting hall, morning. They shuffle up the aisles, Molly and Ralphie, the Stanhopes, Johnny Harriman, Tevye Godso, Kirk and Jenna Freeman, all our new acquaintances, and every face is stamped with fear. Dissolves to 263. Exterior. The Town Hall. Afternoon. Title card. 2 p.m. The snow is still swirling down and the wind is still howling. Parked by the side door is the biggest snowcat on the island, its engine idling. 264. Exterior, the town hall's side door. Closer. Afternoon. Bundled up in the doorway are Mike, Sonny, Henry Bright, and Kirk Freeman. There to see them off, clutching sweaters against the chill, are Molly, Hatch, and Tess Marchant. Once again, they all shout to be heard over the storm. Molly.
Are you sure this is necessary?
Mike.
No, but we're fresh out of weather forecasts, and it's best to be safe. Besides, there's stuff at the market that'll just go over if we don't use it.
Molly.
Fresh orange juice isn't worth risking that psychopath.
Mike.
He's not going to take on four of us.
Molly.
Promise me you'll be careful.
Mike.
I promise.
Shifts his attention to Hatch.
Buddy system, right?
No one gets left alone.
Hatch.
Right. Be careful, you guys.
Sonny.
You better believe it.
As they turn away toward the snowcat. Molly.
Mike, since the house is right on your way...
She stops, a little embarrassed to ask what has come to her mind, but his eyes are kind and encourage her. Molly.
Well, the kids are being as good as they can, but if you could just maybe grab a handful of games and two or three boxes of slipsticks or something, It'd be a lifesaver.
Mike kisses her on the cheek. Consider it done. He goes to the snowcat and slides behind the controls. He guns the engine. They all wave and the snowcat buzzes away into the storm. Tavia.
Will they be all right?
Hatch. Sure. He looks worried, though. They go back inside and shut the door against the storm. 265. Exterior. The Anderson House on Lower Main. Afternoon. The snowcat pulls up in front. The picket fence is totally buried. The Wee Folks Daycare Center sign is lying on top of a 10-foot drift. 266. Interior. The snowcat. Afternoon. Mike, to the others. Just be a minute. He opens the door on his side and gets out. 267. Exterior. Outside the Anderson House with Mike. Afternoon. He slogs around the front of the snowcat, bent over against the snow and wind, and almost runs headlong into Kirk Freeman. Once more, they shout over the wind to be heard. Mike. Get back in and stay warm. I'll be fine. Kirk. Body system, remember? He points into the snowcat at Henry and Sonny. Kirk. We buddy up in there. They buddy up out here. We all buddy up together in the market. Mike. Okay. Come on. They start slogging up what used to be a path to a porch, wallowing under the drifts like a slowly sinking boat. 268. Interior. Cat Withers. Close up. She's sitting on a folding chair and looks pretty vacant. She's got a mug of something in one hand and a sweater pulled over her shoulders. She's still bombed on shock and tranquilizers. In the background, children sing. Children and Sandra Beals. I'm a little teapot, short and stout. Cat reacts to this, but doesn't overreact. She may not remember the song. The camera pulls back to show us the daycare kids. They are being monitored by Robbie and Sandra Beals, buddy system. Sandra is leading the singing and trying to look vivacious. Robbie sits on another wooden chair, looking almost as lost as Cat. The kids are being teapots. As they sing, they make handles of their arms and tug their noses to show they know where their spouts are. Around them, at this end of the common room, which is between the stairs and the wall, is a litter of makeshift amusements. Books, paste, magazines with lots of cutout pictures and scraps, a few toys. Beyond them is a closed door with a plaque on it that reads Custodian. Children and Sandra. Here is my handle. Here is my spout. Kurt Andrews comes down the stairs and stands next to Robbie. Robbie.
I hate that song.
Ferd.
Why?
Robbie.
I just hate it. How's Jack Carver?
Ferd.
Quieted down some. It's just good the women got the kid away from him before he cracked.
Nods at Buster.
There ought to be a search party made up to look for Angela and them others. If Alton Hatcher won't lead it, you could.
Robbie.
And if the search party didn't come back, what then? Send out another one?
Ferd.
Well, we can't just sit here.
Robbie.
Sure we can. And that's just what we're going to do. Sit here and wait out the storm. Pardon me, Ferd. I need a coffee.
Giving Ferd a contemptuous look, Robbie gets to his feet and heads upstairs. Ferd goes after him.
Ferd. I was just thinking we ought to do something, Robbie.
The camera returns to Cat. Her eyes flicker. She sees 269. Insert. Manoj's cane. It swings toward the camera, Silver Wolf's head seeming to snarl. 270. Interior. Resume kids' play area. Afternoon. Cat drops her mug and puts her hands over her face, beginning to sob. The kids stop singing and turn to look at her. Pippa and Heidi start to sniffle in sympathy. Frank Bright.
What's wrong with Katrina Withers?
Sandra.
Nothing, Frankie. She's just tired. You kids pick up a little, okay? Mr. Anderson will be bringing back some new things to play with, I think, so just...
Don.
I'm not going to pick up. My dad will give me a donut.
He dashes for the stairs. Sandra.
Don. Don Beals.
You come back and help the others.
Ralphie, we don't need him. Monkeys can't pick up.
The others snicker. That's a pretty good one. And when Ralphie starts picking up the litter, the rest join in. Sandra goes over and begins comforting Cat. 271. Interior. Isolate on Ralphie. He works his way a little apart from the others, picking up magazines. He's moving toward the door marked custodian, and when it comes open, he looks up.
Winoge, voice. Ralphie. Hey, big boy.
The others do not hear, but Ralphie does. 272. Interior. We Folks Daycare Center with Mike and Kirk. Kirk has an armload of games and those kid puzzles with the great big pieces. Mike has the slipsticks and a few other simple crafts. Kirk.
That it?
Mike.
Yep, should do. Let's...
Something catches his eye. It's a scatter of alphabet blocks on a low work table. Mike kneels beside it, looks thoughtfully at the blocks, then begins to pull some of them together into a line. Kirk, over to have a look.
What you doing?
Mike has used six of the blocks to spell out Minoge. He looks at them, then swaps them around to make Miloge. No, that's nonsense. Next comes Gonile. Kirk.
Gonile. Sounds like an ad for a vacation in Egypt.
273. Interior. The kids' play area. Sandra is busy with Cat, and the other kids have grouped together around some baskets in the corner where they stow the toys, books, and magazines. They're having a good time. No one notices Ralphie as he gets up and walks hesitatingly toward the half-open door of the custodian's closet. Linoge. Voice.
Got something for you, big boy. A present.
Ralphie reaches for the door, then hesitates. Linoge, voice, teasing.
Not afraid, are you?
Ralphie reaches for the door again, this time more decisively. 274. Interior. We Folks Daycare with Mike and Kirk. Kirk is interested now. He moves the blocks himself, making Linoge into Lonig. And suddenly, Mike sees it, his eyes widen with horror. Mike. Jesus and the disciples in the country of the Gadarenes. Book of Mark. Oh, my God. Kirk.
Huh?
Mike. They met a man with an unclean spirit. That's what it says in the gospel. A man with demons inside of him. He lived among the tombs, and no man could bind him, not even with chains. Jesus cast the demons into a herd of pigs that ran into the ocean and drowned themselves. But before he cast them out, Jesus asked their names, and the thing inside said... Kirk is watching him with increasing fright as Mike manipulates the blocks. Mike, our name is Legion, for we are many. Now the blocks that spelled Linoge spell Legion. Mike and Kirk stare at each other, wide-eyed. 275. Interior, outside the custodian's closet. Ralphie opens the door and looks up at André Linoge. In one hand, Linoge grips his wolf's head cane. The other is behind his back. Linoge is smiling.
Linoge, it's a present for the fairy saddle boy. Come and see.
Ralphie enters the custodian's closet. The door swings shut. This ends part two. Part three. The Reckoning. Act one. One. Exterior. The Island Market. Afternoon. The snow is falling as hard as ever. The porch is almost completely buried beneath one huge dune-like drift from floor to roof overhang. Parked in front is the big snowcat Mike and the others took out on the reprovisioning expedition. From its side door to the door of the market, a notch almost like a tunnel has been dug. The four men, Mike Anderson, Sonny Brodigan, Henry Bright, and Kirk Freeman, are just entering. Two. Interior, the market, by the cash registers, afternoon. The men make their way in, gasping and shedding snow. Sonny and Henry have shovels. We can see their breath in the air, and the place is very dim. Sonny.
Jenny's out. Mike nods. How long do you think?
Mike. Hard to tell. Since morning, anyway, from the way it feels, snow probably piled up and blocked the exhaust. He goes to the cash registers, bends beneath one, and begins to toss out big cardboard cartons. Mike. Sonny, Henry, your meat patrol. Get the big cuts of beef, plus the turkeys and chicken. The best stuff's back in the freezer. Henry.
Will it still be all right, do you think?
Mike. Are you kidding?
It won't even be thawed yet.
Come on, let's go. Dark's gonna come early. Sonny and Henry start up toward the cooler and the freezer beyond. Kirk comes over to the checkout and takes one of the cartons.
Mike.
We'll stick to the canned goods this trip.
All of us will come back for bread, potatoes, and vegetables, and milk. Little kids have to have milk.
Kirk.
You gonna tell him about what the guy's name spells when you move the blocks around?
Mike. What good would it do?
Kirk.
I don't know. God, Mike, that gave me a chill.
Mike.
Me too. And for the time being, maybe we better just keep the chill to ourselves. We've still got at least one more night to get through.
Kirk.
But...
Mike. Come on. Canned goods. Let's load up. He starts up the aisle containing the overturned card table, and after a moment or two's consideration, Kirk follows.
3. Exterior, the town hall, afternoon. We can barely see it in all the snow, but at regular intervals we can hear the blare of a horn.
4. Exterior, the parking lot, afternoon. The island services vehicle is idling here, not too far from the town hall side door. It's not going to go anywhere. Not even a four-wheel drive can move in 5 feet of snow. But the lights are on, and we can see one man standing outside and another inside. The one behind the wheel is Hatch. The one outside, wearing his VFD parka and peering anxiously into the snow, is Ferd Andrews. The window between them is open. Snow is blowing into the cab of the truck, but at this point, neither man cares. Ferd cups his hands around his mouth and hollers into the shrieking wind as loud as he can.
Ferd.
Angie Carver. Billy Timmons.
Hatch.
Any sign? Any at all?
Ferd.
No. Wouldn't I tell you? Keep blowing that thing.
Hatch continues to lay on the horn in long, measured beats. Ferd peers anxiously into the snow, then turns and yanks open the door.
Ferd.
You watch and let me honk. Your eyes are better.
They change places.
Hatch, squinting into the snow.
George Kirby.
Janie Kingsbury, where are you guys?
Ferd keeps blowing the horn in long, measured blasts.
5.
Interior. The town hall's makeshift daycare area. Afternoon.
Sound.
Muffled. The horn continues. The kids have finished picking up and don't really know what to do with themselves now. No one has noticed that Ralphie Anderson isn't among them. Sandra has gotten Cat quieted down and now looks restless herself. Cat sees this and offers Sandra a wan smile and a pat on the arm.
Cat.
I'm okay. Go on up. Find your husband and little boy.
Sandra.
But the kids.
Cat gets up and approaches them. Sandra watches apprehensively. This is the young woman who beat her boyfriend to death not long ago.
Cat.
Who wants to play Giant Step?
Heidi.
Yeah.
Sally Gosso.
Me. Yay, I do.
The kids start to line up facing Cat. Only Buster Carver lags.
Buster.
Where's my mommy?
Sandra.
I'll just peek and see if she's upstairs, shall I? Or your daddy?
Buster.
Yes, please, Mrs. Beale.
Pippa.
And send Don down. He always forgets to say, may I?
The others laugh gleefully, including Buster.
Frank takes Buster's arm.
Come on, you play next to me. We'll be partners.
Buster starts, then stops.
Where's Ralphie?
There's a moment of nervousness as they all look around and realize Ralphie isn't there. Cat turns to Sandra, an eyebrow raised in question. Sandra.
He probably chased upstairs after Donnie to see if he could get a donut, too. I'll send them both down.
She goes upstairs. The other kids are satisfied with this explanation, except for Pippa, who's looking around with a frown. Pippa.
He didn't go upstairs with Donnie Beals. At least, I don't think he did.
Upton Bell comes over, grinning like the amiable fool he is. Sally Godso.
Who's blowing that horn, Mr. Bell?
Upton. Someone trying to call the snowbirds, I guess. Frank.
What are snowbirds?
Upton. You never heard of snowbirds? Kids.
No, no. What are they? Tell us.
Etc. Upton.
Oh, big as refrigerators they are. White as snow and tasty as the devil. But they only fly around when there's a big blizzard. Only time there's wind enough to give them the lift. To them a horn's just like a bird call. But they're cussed hard to catch just the same. Can I play too?
Kid.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
Etc. Pippa has been looking around for Ralphie, but now she joins in, distracted from her concern by her delight at having a grown-up who's willing to play the game with them. Cat.
Get right in line, Upton Bell. Just don't be smart, and don't forget to say, may I? Now, here we go. Frank Bright, take two helicopter steps.
Frank takes two steps forward, whirling around, flapping his arms, and making helicopter sounds. Kids.
You forgot to say, may I?
Grinning, shamefaced, Frank goes back. The camera moves away from the game to the closed door marked custodian. 6. Interior, the town meeting hall, afternoon. Sound, muffled. The horn continues. In the foreground, we see Molly Anderson sitting beside Jack Carver on one of those hard meeting benches, trying to soothe him. In the background, at the rear of the long room, is the buffet, where people are coming and going, getting coffee and snacks. Some look toward Molly and Jack, troubled and sympathetic, but not Robbie Beals and his son Don. They are eating donuts with a remarkable lack of concern. Robbie has coffee. Don is slurping a Coke. Jack.
I got to find her.
He makes an effort to rise, and Molly puts a hand on his arm, holding him where he is for the time being. Molly.
You know what it's like out there?
Jack.
She could be wandering around, freezing to death in a whiteout 50 yards from the building.
Molly.
And if you go out there, you'll be lost too. If they're there, they'll come to the horn, same as in a fog at sea. You know that.
Jack.
I'll go out Spelford.
Molly.
Hatch said...
Jack,
Alton Hatcher can't tell me what to do. That's my wife out there.
She can't stop him this time, so she gets up with him. Behind them, Sandra comes in from the town office area, looks around, spots her husband and son. Molly,
go to the truck then, but just to the truck. Don't go wandering off on your own.
But Jack can promise her no such thing. He's totally distracted. Molly watches sadly as he goes up the aisle, then follows herself. Sandra, meanwhile, is looking around. She doesn't see Molly yet. Sandra, to Don.
Where's Ralphie?
Don, munching his donut.
I don't know.
Sandra.
But didn't he come upstairs with you?
Molly is in time to hear this and is, of course, immediately concerned. Don.
Nah. He is picking up with the rest of them. Dad, can I have another donut?
Molly, to Sandra.
He's not down there? What are you saying, that he's not with the others?
Sandra, flustered.
I didn't see. Cat started to cry. She dropped her cup and broke it.
Molly.
You were supposed to be watching them.
Sandra winces. She's been married to Robbie for 10 years and is used to being blamed when things go wrong. Robbie, the usual bluster.
I hardly think that tone is...
Molly ignores him,
You were supposed to be watching them.
She breaks for the stairs.
Ralphie! Ralphie!
7. Exterior, the island market, afternoon. The men are clustered at the snowcat, handing loaded cartons to Mike, who stows them in the back. Mike shouts to be heard over the storm as the last box goes in. Mike, one more trip, Sonny. You and Henry get the bread and rolls. Everything on the shelves. Kirk, you want to grab at least 100 pounds of potatoes. I'll get the milk. Let's go. I want to get back as soon as we can. They go single file into the cut in the drift, Sonny and Henry Bright first, followed by Mike and Kirk. Sonny and Henry go inside. Mike is about to follow, then stops so suddenly that Kirk just about runs into him. Kirk, what the hell? Mike has stopped at the mannequin set up on the porch. Hatches joke at Robbie Beals' expense. The mannequin is now almost completely buried, and although the face is covered with wind-driven snow, and the figure is still dressed in the lobsterman slicker, we can see it's not the same figure. End of side 5.